Today it's my pleasure, however, to introduce Paul Shervish, who's joining us today to speak on philanthropy as a spiritual exercise, soul, relationships, and community. Professor Shervish is a professor of sociology and director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. He's also a National Research Fellow at the Indiana University Center on Philanthropy and an advisor to the Templeton Foundation. His master's degree is from Northwestern and a Master of Divinity from the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley. And a PhD in sociology was earned from the University of Wisconsin. He's also the director of a study on wealth, values, and philanthropy funded by the Gates Foundation. And he helped to found the Wealth and Giving Forum in 2003, which we may hear a little bit about today. He's the author of, I think, 4 books. Is that right? Most recently, Wealth and the Will of God, Discerning the Use of Riches in the Service of Ultimate Purpose, published last year. So we're delighted to have...
Published? No.
No?
We don't know. It's in the catalog. Oh. We made him change it to a 2010 date.
Okay, sorry.
You know, you want to be in the next decade at least.
All right, so it's in the pipeline.
They got a picture of it. Any day now.
Check your local listings. It'll hit our shelf soon. And for all this and so much more, we're delighted to have you here, Professor Shervish.
Thanks, Eric. And it is my pleasure to have you here. What a diverse group of people. Are some of you students in theology or
how about sociology? Actually,
are you? Well, I'm a sociologist. Be careful. You can talk to me anytime if you are interested in this. We're going to have an undergraduate philanthropy course in the fall. Yeah, so keep your eye out for it. And you are where?
In the School of Education.
Okay, good. And we have Kathy Coy from Development. Sir, you?
I'm actually a construction contractor, self-employed.
And how come you're here?
I study ways insurance is similar to church.
The way insurance is...
Insurance groups are similar to church groups, and actually insurance marginalizes religion. And actuarial science is a new form of morality. So that's my...
Well, maybe you could ask a direct question.
They both deal with risk.
Ask a direct question. Is that the answer? They both deal with risk, or
you're exactly right. Except for morality should be the risk management should be parsed out from morality. Real morality has to do with questions of obligations, and not with our emotions.
Okay.
I set up a nonprofit as spiritual exercise. So I'm interested in how you match.
That's your area?
It's a non-conversation.
A non-profit is spiritual exercise?
Yeah, basically.
Good.
I use Ignatian discernment, but it's a long...
Well, maybe you should give this talk.
I'm interested in how you
sure.
ask the question.
And you are?
International Studies in French.
Yep.
And I work at Boston.
And you're from Georgia.
I am from Georgia.
I just want to know who the author is. Candace Hetzner.
I'm Associate Dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and a political scientist who's currently trying to work on issues of insurance and responsibility.
And Alan, we all know Sayo.
This is Sayo. I'm a student, sociology PhD candidate, and Alan is my second leader, and I'm studying about multiple secularities in regard to rethinking considering of secularization in the United States.
My name is Beth Hale, and I'm a fourth year in the doctoral program in theological ethics.
I'm Celso Perez, a master's student in theology.
Yep. And our other guest.
I'm Barbara Flannery, and my background has been in education. I started in political science with education, and I'm just
going
to
make myself. And I'm Lisa Berlinger, and my areas are organizational behavior and, of course, nonprofits, and I teach at Fairfield University.
Well, thank you for coming, all of you. I'm going to talk for just a few minutes, and Eric, I would like you to kind of give me a 5-minute sign, because we want to have a discussion, okay?
We'll do.
And I could go on forever, but... because I make this up as I go along, it could just continue. One of the things that I wanted to emphasize by working on this paper, and this was given at the Lake Institute at Indiana University, the Lake Institute on Faith and Philanthropy, as their annual lecture in 2008. And the idea is to examine philanthropy as spiritual exercise, but more than philanthropy, something deeper, receiving and giving. And that need not be occurring in formal philanthropy. And I'm going to take us past formal philanthropy, or deeper than formal philanthropy at one point, and talk about what it is that formal philanthropy is one expression of. But one of the things that has always been of interest to me is asceticism. And the reason for that is, even in my own religious training, I always wondered, how do I get from here to there? And you hardly ever hear a sermon, unless you're in good theology studies, about mysticism or the spiritual path, or you're a Buddhist, or another group that meditates, you're not taught in asceticism. The most we might do in the Catholic tradition is prayers of petition. I've done this to her before, so it doesn't bother me a bit.
Almost every time you
So I'm talking in this as a way to understand how do we do personal formation in that realm of what we call receiving and giving. And I often have done my research on wealth holders, and you may hear me speak about wealth holders, but this really applies to everybody. And I'm talking about how the understandings I'm presenting apply to three areas: our soul, our relationships, and then to our society. And to make sure that I can get everything in, I'm now going to read you the last paragraph of this paper. And I took this from people from Feuerbach to theological writers that have their readers join in kind of a blessing or prayer of some kind. So I say, may all our asceticism of the soul convey us to daily life as spiritual exercise. Receiving and giving is at once and at once and inseparably a unity of inner, relational, and societal spiritual exercise. Just as inner exercise flows into outer exercise without borders, outer exercise flows into inner exercise without borders. The Holy Trinity of spiritual exercise is compassionate souls, relationships of philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, and the moral citizenship of care. I didn't write down amen, but you could have. So I want to talk about these areas. Once we have an inner asceticism, these dualisms between soul and relationships, person and society, care for self and care for world, or care for the cosmos, these no longer are real boundaries. And so I'm really presenting what I learned in the Jesuit novitiate, which is you find God in all things. And more deeply than that, you may not be bringing God. And your vocation is to find all that. All is a rich territory. And you find it, and so you live your daily life as experience of the spiritual life. But in addition to doing that, which is the end, we always want to develop that, I want to say something about how you get there, which, as I said earlier, always bothered me. Right? You never got instruction on that. So my key question is, how do we shift wealth? And this is all of our wealth, our intellectual wealth, our human capital, whatever we can put capital after. Our friendships, our associations, our armies, our institutes, right? Our brains. How do we shift all that capacity to a means? And this may be arguably one of the most important questions for the 21st century, in addition to, oh, maybe 20 others that our two presidents, recent presidents, have put on the table that we now have to deal with, especially for our kids, how they're going to pay for my luxurious life with their taxes. And when I said thank you to my students for taking care of me, they said, what should we do? And then I went in to explain what a social movement is. And I suggested they start an AAYP. An association of young persons. And of course, get discounts on airlines. The way I express the question is, how are we going to use our capacities as a tool for deeper purposes, and especially in the area of our money, when acquiring more wealth or a higher standard of living is no longer of high importance? And that question can be asked very much at the surface, but it can be asked at a much deeper level. I think that we have been shortchanged by our schools, our theology programs, our sermons, our spiritual direction, because we have not developed a contemporary understanding of wealth. We still have, for the most part, a feudal understanding of distributional dimensions of wealth, not its productive dimensions. And the bishops still think that way. They very seldom introduce a spirituality of accumulating money, much less a modern spirituality of allocation. There's an old spirituality of allocation. And as the Sufis might say, halls and colleges and learned discourses and porch and arch, what advantage are they when the wise heart and seeing eye are absent? So the bigger picture of what I'm trying to do is to see what the wise heart and seeing eye can learn today about these questions of allocation of capacity. And it is my belief that fresh and contemporary learning is available if you were to listen for it. And you would listen for it in the stories of the generations of wealth holders. And you would listen to what is the deepest hurt that they have provided or received. And what is the deepest hurt that wealth has done to their children, or they children have received, or what is the greatest blessing in all those arenas? And then you want to talk about the experience of gratitude that many of them express. And you don't want to just hear the conclusion that I'm grateful. You want to explore the causal path to that gratitude. And you don't want to just see people exercising virtue of generosity you want to make sure that they understand that generosity is not an end virtue, despite the Templeton Foundation constantly talking about it. Wisdom is the end virtue. The Sufis say that good people want to treat others the way they are treated. Generous people want to treat others better than the way they're treated. But they go on to say, do not indulge, that's the interesting word, do not indulge in being good or generous. Be wise. Treat people in the way they need to be treated. So that you don't become, in the phrase, greedy about generosity. Now, Kathy, you saw how I got around that problem by talking about how we have to understand generosity in a positive light as an end, if you mean building the genus, so that I could then write something to a Templeton program. Jack Templeton is really just, he thinks that's the key term, and there is something to it. I think it's not the ultimate, but it's certainly close to the penultimate, you know, disposition. So, as part of this fresh learning, I made an assumption, an ontological assumption, that this is the way the world works. That God, reality, whatever you want to call it, the universe, first produces and provides us with an appropriate faculty. And this connects in some ways to sociobiology, such that our most profound first contact is the receiving of the gracious gift of life. We may not reflect on it, or we may experience it profoundly as we advance in life. And it is from God, or being, or the great force, from God through our parents and others who care for us. So we are first receivers. And if we haven't been cared for, we are first missers of being able to be receivers and injured by the lack of reception. Now, this one priest gave his only good sermon. And I put myself in this when I was a priest. I never heard a bad sermon because I was giving them. He said that children do not need to learn how to love. They need to learn how to first be loved. And I have paid attention to that little two sentences for a long, long time. And so I believe that this notion of receiving is prior to giving. If you have some ontological view of the world in which you have to figure out how you got here with your capacities and happinesses and reflective abilities. So given that, how we got there, I want to figure out how we can dig deeper into, purposefully, an asceticism of receiving and giving. How do we strengthen that inner muscle, if you will? And so I want to talk about spiritual exercise. And I drew on, of course, Ignatius Loyola. But another one, Karl Fried Graf von Durkheim. Has anybody heard of him that hasn't read this paper? It's not Emil Durkheim. It's Karl Fried. But he's a philosopher, a meditation adept, and spiritual teacher. And he wrote a book, Daily Life as Spiritual Exercise, The Way of Transformation. And if you want to get that book, you can't look up that title anymore. You got to look up The Way of Transformation, Daily Life as Spiritual Exercise. I have no idea why they switched it. So drawing on those two, let me start with Durkheim. And he suggests that what you want to do with these exercises is join the army. That is, you want to be all that you can be. and it's connected to Aristotle's notion of formal cause. That is, you want to be a human being at your fullest. You want the tree to become what it is genetically. We use that term genetically now. But there's some kind of inside cause that makes an apple tree shorter than an elm tree, or tells a blade of grass to stop growing at a certain point, or tells bamboo to keep growing. And he says these things so that the end of life is the unity of the worldly and inner tasks. Now, the way I began to talk about receiving and giving as spiritual exercise, I turned to Pema Chodron, a Buddhist nun who is a U.S. or American. She lives in Canada, so she's a North American. I don't know if she was born in Canada or not. But she is a Buddhist teacher, and she speaks a lot about Tonglen, T-O-N-G-L-E-N. And that is a asceticism, a meditative asceticism that you can do as you walk down the street or as you meditate. And you can practice this for others, you can practice it for yourself, and you can practice it for yourself and all the millions of people who are like you. And Tonglen is first and foremost a receiving. So in the inner breath, even if you're walking down the street, you receive into yourself the suffering. And as you exhale, and maybe when you're walking, you'll want to maybe do this on the basis of two or three breaths so that you don't run into a traffic sign. But you exhale a care, a relief for the person. And this practice begins, she says, by taking on the suffering of a person whom we know to be suffering and wish to help. We identify that suffering as best we can and breathe it in with the desire to remove all pain. As we breathe out, we send happiness or whatever would relieve the person's suffering. The method is straightforward, breathing in others' pain so they can be well and have more space to relax and be open. Breathing out, sending them relaxation or whatever we feel would bring them relief and happiness, what they need. Okay? Now this can be done in meditation as well. And you can do it for yourself. When you are suffering, when you are on the point, she says, when you have just yelled at somebody and they deserved it, but now you feel terrible remorse because you know that there's a deeper way to handle this. Have you ever had that experience? I have lived with that for ages. So it also works for us in our physical suffering, if we had AIDS. And there are groups of AIDS patients that practice Tonglen. And what they do is they, like the monks do, like the Buddhists do, they breathe in the suffering of the world connected to their suffering and breathe out relief for others who are suffering like them and even sometimes for people who are suffering differently. And you can do this with happiness too. You can experience the happiness and breathe it in and then amplify it in your outer breath. Now, I don't have the time to go in to thoroughly examine that. I've already gone over my speaking time, but I want to end by talking about, if that's the inner soul method, I want to talk about relationships, what this does to relationships. Pema Chodron will insist that this certainly leads to compassion. None of this ever is dead-ended in what we call this dualism between personal self-development and care or compassion for others. It is remarkable how often when the first topic is discussed, somebody always raises a hand and it says, you mean we're not supposed to take care of other people who are suffering in the world? That's why I developed the sections, which I've worked on in other ways, on relationships, and then the moral or spiritual citizenship of care in the society. A relationship, let me just call it a relationship of philia. This turns out, this Tonglen can be influential in developing what Aristotle talks about as philia, or friendship love. And it is mutual nourishment. And you see how Tonglen is already mutual nourishment. So you take that notion of friendship, and he agrees that friendship is in these concentric circles, all the way from friendship with self, and from parent and child friendship, to friendships of with close and intimate friends, to associates, to contractual friends, to friends of convenience. And none of them are to be taken out of this experience of mutual nourishment. Now, what makes friendship love different from a commercial relationship? I go into this in detail in a lot of places, but this is what is the essence of philia or care. You see, we all have a moral biography, and I can't tell you how to exercise yours, because as soon as I tell that to you, you can trump me back, right? You can tell me, you say, well, we ought to be working with the inner city poor of Boston. And I say, why aren't you doing that? Right? And when you go do that, I'll ask you why you're not in Africa. Right? And then you'll meet Mother Teresa and she'll send you back here. So philia is this relationship in which you're not responding to the medium through which a need is expressed. If you're buying a car, Kathy, how will you get the car from me?
I will come and get it.
No, you won't. You're not stealing it from me. How are you going to get the car?
I will give you money.
Yes. Yes. Show me the money. Now, I, as the car dealer, the supplier, will respond to your demand or need by paying attention, not just to you, but through the medium through which you express your need. Because if I don't pay attention to that, I'm going out of business. Okay? Philia is that relationship where you need a car now to go to work, and there is a nonprofit organization that provides automobiles to people that can get a job out in the suburbs, but there's no public transportation. So how do you get that car?
For that car, I express my need to that organization.
Yes. And so instead of paying attention to the medium through which the need is expressed, you pay attention directly to the person in need. See that? And you're paying attention to entreaty, whether it's verbalized or not. Now, formal philanthropy is a formal expression of that. But we're carrying out philia in so many different ways. Like when you allow me to come in my your office and talk to you, and then you even laugh at my jokes, which I always think is a great act of friendship love.
I always pray ahead of time.
Wait, is that formal philanthropy too?
No, that's care. That's philia. That's not formal philanthropy. Jesus didn't practice formal philanthropy. The Buddha didn't practice. There were no deductions and no formal nonprofit sector. See, we define, if I come to your door, and we do this too, if I want to know how much you've given to charity, I will ask you, how many dollars did you give to a legal charity and to a nonprofit, okay? But if you have just given $10,000 to your brother whose child has autism, You can't tell me that that's formal philanthropy.
Right, but I'll tell you, but that's because you know I know. I mean...
Tell me what?
I'll tell you, I just gave $10,000 to
and
another...
In our research, we will write that down.
Right.
As philia. And when we did our Boston area diary study, we found that the formal giving of these households equaled almost to the penny the national average. But they all gave with goods, like an automobile, or buying clothes for their poor daughters, kids. We're not talking inheritances, we're not talking birthday gifts, we're not talking Christmas gifts. They gave five times more. Moral citizenship of care. I define civil society as that arena where people are paying attention directly to persons in need rather than to the medium through which they express their need. See, because government is paying attention to votes and campaign contributions and bribes. In commerce, you're paying attention. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't care or philia in commercial and political relations. But that arena, people have always asked, what is civil society? I think it's wherever these relationships that are paying attention directly to people in need. So it includes the family. It may not include a certain charity. I mean, when a pastor tells you, this is God's money, give it to this church, I always say, it's God's money, but it's not your money.
Creflo Dollar.
What?
Creflo Dollar.
What does that mean?
Creflo Dollar is a person, he is the highest paid, but you should have him in your Rolodex.
It's prosperity gospel. That's what I
agree. $45 million, and he testified before Senator Grassley that was a lot of money, but it was not an illegal amount. Compensation for him to get. He's in Atlanta.
Oh.
He's my favorite.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, I'm done.